Pseudopod, episode 182, February 19th, 2010. This week's story, The Dreaming Way, by Jim Baye. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I, as ever, am Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from the ever-reliable Jim Baye. Jim's a regular around these parts, and this story forms another part of his superb Coyote Tales series. Your narrator this week is also a veteran, the inimitable Cayenne Chris Conroy. So study hard, because there will be a test on what I assure you is a true story.
The Dreaming Way, by Jim Baye. Lynette Yazzie never missed a problem on a test. In science class, she balanced chemical equations beautifully. English gave her time to sprint through sentence diagrams. During her 7th grade algebra final, Lynette had scratched through each equation before her teacher had finished passing out all the test booklets. The girl's inexhaustible memory dominated the lunchtime conversations in the Ganado Middle School faculty lounge. But her teachers knew something else about her. She'd never earned an A in a single class. On the rare occasions when she turned in homework, it was usually incomplete or nearly illegible. Yet when test day came, she never missed. Lynette typically walked into class just as the bell rang, sat quietly in the farthest corner closest to the door, and hunched her massive frame into her puffy Chicago Bulls jacket that had been provided free by the tribe for poor Navajo kids like her. The jacket helped her sneak in a cheap CD player she'd repaired with duct tape, which allowed her to spend most of class nodding her head to country music while her teachers went through the day's lessons. Her teachers never asked her to remove her headphones. What was the point? The girl earned 100% on every quiz and exam, and when they called on her, Lynette spat the answer back like a rifle ejecting a shell. "The girl just has a way with tests," her teachers repeated. "She knows how to prepare." But Lynette caught a lot of shit for her test grades. Part of the Navajo culture said you weren't supposed to stand out from the group, but Lynette already stood out. "Lynette! Lynette! Teacher's pet!" went the usual recess refrain. "Lynette! Lynette! Teacher's pet, about as tall as a jumbo jet." And Lynette was tall. She towered past 6 feet by the time she reached 8th grade, and her long black hair that she rarely brushed only made her seem taller when it fell down over her wide shoulders. She was heavy set, truly big boned, more muscle than fat. And she put that muscle to use during the Lynette incidents, as they came to be called. Lynette Incident 1. In 5th grade, Milo Roanhorse had pulled Lynette's ponytail as she was walking down the hallway until Lynette turned and shoved him so hard against the wall that Milo crumpled unconscious beneath a newly dented locker. The next day, Milo's older brother, a muscular 8th grader named Adrian, stalked Lynette after school and hit her from behind with a jagged piece of petrified wood he'd found near the swing set. While doctors had been able to reattach her left ear, Lynette kept a thick, pale scar that grew out along her jaw like a sycamore branch. Incident 2. In 6th grade, Tina Sinigini had ripped up one of Lynette's notebooks when rumors spread that Lynette had been writing love poems to Tina's latest boyfriend. Lynette caught her. Doctors at Sage Memorial Hospital used 12 stitches to close a gash along Tina's left cheekbone where Lynette had smacked the girl, just once, after Tina had flicked out a box cutter. Incident 3. Today. Milo Roanhorse and his gang of 8th grade buddies had shuffled behind Lynette in their baggy pants and black sweatshirts, calling her Bijoux's Dijoux, prickly pussy. Lynette turned on Milo and told him she wouldn't tell his mom or his bros that he'd had sex with 3 sheep at his grandma's sheep camp last summer, that he'd shot the animals afterwards, buried the evidence in a wash, and then told his grandma the coyotes had killed them. Gus Fakowski, Lynette's 8th grade math teacher, stepped forward to break up the scene. He later said in the faculty room that Milo's face had turned pale and, as Gus put it, "it looked like someone had just kicked him in the balls." Milo shoved Lynette. Then she did kick him in the balls. 3 of Milo's bros joined in, but they never landed a punch as Lynette flailed with elbow and fist until she drove them into the girls' bathroom. "It's where you pussies belong," she'd yelled. Then she put in her earbuds, turned on her CD player, and walked with Gus Fakowski to the principal's office. For her teachers, Lynette incidents were a celebration of a moral universe, a place where the future criminals of the Navajo Nation went looking for a helpless victim and found themselves in a hospital emergency room, courtesy of poor, quiet, battle-scarred Lynette Yazzie. So no one ever bothered Lynette. Her mom came from her housekeeping job at the hospital and picked Lynette up in the nurse's office, and Lynette was back in school the next day. Today, after her visit to the principal's office with Mr. Vikowski, Lynette knew her mother, Wanda Yazzie, would be out of town. So she walked alone to their trailer, dropped her backpack next to the kitchen table, and grabbed the leash on the television set. Rocky, the family's blue heeler, waited for her in the bathroom where he slept on one of Lynette's old sweatshirts during the day. She leashed him and walked him out to the small mesa on the other side of the wash. She had rescued and bottle-fed Rocky from a litter of pups whose mother had died at her auntie's house in Kinlichi, and she made sure Rocky got his walk every day. They climbed to the top of the maroon clay mesa and took in the clear view of the Ganado Valley, with its small roofs jutting through the naked cottonwoods and Chinese elms eager to bud and green in the coming spring. A mile in the distance, Highway 264 stretched out from east to west, running from Window Rock all the way to Kames Canyon and the Hopi Reservation. Lynette could see a tall, skinny man walking next to the highway. He wore a jean jacket and a wide straw cowboy hat, a typical Rez hitchhiker. She barely took notice of him, but when she saw the man wander onto the road just as a tractor trailer bore down on him, she felt her gut shrink up. The man was probably some crazy Atlani, a homeless drunk, and she was about to watch him die on the highway. But the hitchhiker stepped out of the way at the last second, like a bullfighter, slapping the truck's front fender as it shot by, then continued walking down the middle of the highway, his hands in his pockets. The truck had never honked or swerved. He danced through three more cars before stepping off the road near the chapter house and walking down the hill into Ganado. Lynette wondered why the cars weren't braking to avoid the hitchhiker. They just drove past him, as though he weren't there. She and Rocky made it back to the trailer as the air chilled and the sun reddened against the mesas. It was quiet, and Lynette wondered why her mother hadn't returned. A note in the kitchen told her Wanda had needed to drive to Pinon that night and wouldn't be home for dinner. Next to the note was a $5 bill. Lynette smiled and appreciated the thoughtfulness, even though she knew she was being ditched so her mom could go and get laid by her boyfriend. She walked to her bedroom, searching for change between her pink My Little Pony lamp and the Dallas Cowboys Super Bowl clock on her dresser. Before she left the room, she checked her appearance in a silver-plated circular mirror that hung above her dresser. The mirror was studded with 6 turquoise stones along its circumference and looked like it might fetch a lot of money in a pawn shop. But Lynette knew she'd never trade it. Whether by a tilt of the light or the well-placed shadows in the room, whenever Lynette looked into the mirror, the mutilation of the sycamore branch scar on her face seemed to fade to invisibility. Her face looked slimmer, her hair finer and darker, her neck less thick and more elegant beneath her strong chin. In the mirror, she was a Navajo warrior woman. In the mirror, she was special. It was her magic mirror. After she placed Rocky in the bathroom with a fresh dish of water, she locked the front and back door, walked up the road to Cafe Sage, and ordered a Billy Burger with cheese and fries. After she picked up her order, she sat at the table in the far west corner of the dining room, pulled an R.L. Stein paperback out of her coat pocket, and began to eat. Perhaps because she had just reached the chapter where Stein's anonymous serial killer had entered the babysitter's house, or because she'd realized she'd forgotten ketchup for her fries, Lynette didn't see the hitchhiker until he sat down across from her and offered her a Heinz ketchup bottle.
Ja, te shitsi, he said, setting the bottle in front of her.
His jean jacket and wranglers were tight against his tall, skinny frame and seemed to creak as he pulled his seat forward. He pushed a strand of gray blonde hair back from his ears, and his thin, angular jaws were silver with 2 days' growth. His light brown skin reminded Lynette of a Mexican, although he could have been a half-breed Navajo. From beneath his wire-rimmed glasses, Lynette could feel his intelligent eyes studying her. They were odd eyes, the amber color of pine gum flecked with green. Lynette reached for the Heinz bottle, popped the cap, and replaced the splotch of ketchup on her plate. I saw you on the highway, she said, dipping her fries. The hitchhiker laughed quietly, grinning like a coyote. What's so funny? She said.
You're very trusting, he said. That's good. I had worried about that.
He pulled a handkerchief from his back pocket and motioning to the ketchup bottle.
That is, you took my gift without question. Most wouldn't do that.
Lynette shrugged. The old man smiled, his teeth as white and polished as bleached bone.
Look, my mom only gave me $5 for this burger, so if you want any money, Lynette started.
Ah, I don't want any money, he said. Not so trusting now, are you? Good. People like us can't always be so trusting.
What? She said. Do you know my mom?
You were trusting enough to take my gift, though, he said, ignoring the question. I'm curious to know what other gifts you'll take.
He wiped his hands in his red, yellow, and blue handkerchief printed with the patterns of the Arizona state flag. She gripped the ends of her tray as though to rise and move, but the old man slowly placed his hand over her plate.
Please, he said. Please, don't go.
What I have to say, it's important. His eyes seemed to beg and command at the same time, like Rocky's eyes when he wanted to be fed. What? She said.
In 6 days, he said, stuffing his handkerchief into his pocket, 45 students at Ganado Middle School are going to be killed. I don't know how or why, but I've already seen them. Dead and bleeding on the basketball court, twitching like trout.
Lynette chewed slowly on her last French fry. The hitchhiker produced a can of Dr. Pepper from under his seat, popped the top, drank deeply, and belched. And why are you telling me? She said, avoiding the temptation to feel the sycamore branch scar along her jaw. Why should I care?
Because you can save them, the hitchhiker said, with my help.
Why should I? She said.
Because I know why you never miss a problem on a test, Lynette.
The hitchhiker leaned closer and whispered.
I know about your magic mirror.
What? She said.
No one's asking questions now about a girl who can't turn in her homework or read at grade level, but scores A pluses on tests as easy as killing gnats, he said. But someone might. Soon. State police might follow it up. FBI, maybe, like the X-Files. People disappear off Indian reservations all the time. They'll ask you questions you can't answer until you show them your magic mirror. Or they break you. And then it's 7 years, bad luck, and no dessert. Do you understand?
He pointed to the sycamore branch scar along her cheek.
I'd guess you already understand about being broken. About bad luck, huh?
Who are you? Lynette asked. The hitchhiker placed his hands flat on the table, stuck his tongue far out of his mouth, and pinched it between his teeth. Then he spoke.
I know what you are, and what you can do.
His words were as clear as the sound from her CD player, and the hitchhiker had kept his tongue still the entire time. His lips hadn't moved. He couldn't have spoken.
All you have to do is answer me, and I can promise things will be all right. Don't answer, and I'll walk out this building, hit the road. The students will die, and you'll never see me again.
Lynette looked to the register and saw the cashier had gone back into the kitchen to help the cook. No one was watching. She looked intently at the old man and spoke without words, like she'd done many times before, just like she'd seen her magic mirror over her teacher's heads during tests, a turquoise and silver magic mirror like the one over her dresser, a mirror nobody but Lynette could see. In it, she'd seen the answers to her tests, just like she'd used the mirror to see through others' minds, to hear them talking before they spoke, to hear their secrets. But the more she listened, the louder the voices became. Soon she couldn't control them. She'd started using the headphones, relying on the loud music to keep the voices back, to help her focus. But focusing had been hard since then.
No,
she said without speaking.
Don't leave.
The hitchhiker grinned his coyote grin.
I wasn't planning on it.
Do you have a mirror, too? She asked.
I practically invented them, daughter. And if you let me, I'll show you how to use yours. It can do things you can't even imagine. A lot more than help you score a few A's on some public school tests you could probably pass without much studying anyway, smart girl like you. You seem shocked. Just take a drink and calm down. There are things I have to show you for you to understand.
Lynette lifted her cup and took 3 long swigs. Her Coke was flat and tasteless. When she looked down, she noticed the fluid in the cup was as colorless and clear as the ice cubes.
Water is a lot better for you, the hitchhiker said. Keeps your mind pure.
Lynette dropped the cup like it had a snake in it. It had been filled with Coke, and now it was water. What the hell are you doing? She said, feeling her own voice pounding against her skull.
I'm doing what you've been doing all these years. I'm just taking things a bit further for you. We're looking a little deeper into the magic mirror now. Mind reading, prophecy, telepathy, telekinesis. They're all trees growing from the same root. Dreams, daughter. I'm talking about dreams. And you are a dream thrower.
How did you change my cup?
I didn't, or at least I only made you see that I changed it. Whether or not I actually did is irrelevant.
So, you didn't change it?
No.
Then, this is only happening in my head?
Well, of course.
Then he opened his mouth and spoke using words.
But, why should that mean that it isn't real?
The return to human words was rough, like taking off a warm jacket during a snowstorm. Lynette kept her mouth closed.
How did you do that? She asked. What do you mean I'm a dream thrower?
The hitchhiker produced his Arizona flag handkerchief again, rubbed his hands through it, and the red, yellow, and blue faded until the cloth was as white as a paper napkin. He spread it on the table and traced a circle with his fingertips over the cloth, divided evenly by a thin black line running down its diameter. One side of the circle was shaded charcoal black. The other was white.
"What if I told you that people are never not dreaming?" the hitchhiker said, motioning to the circle.
Lynette watched the circle as it began to rotate slowly like a bicycle wheel.
"What is the difference between a dream and a thought?"
"During dreams, you're asleep," Lynette said. "When you're awake, you're thinking." The center line in the spinning circle wavered until it resembled an aerial photograph of the Grand Canyon that Lynette had seen in a National Geographic magazine.
"There is no difference between dreams and thought. They are the same. This dark half of the circle is what we don't know we know."
He pointed to the white half.
"This other half is what we know we know."
"What's the line in the middle?" Lynette said, intrigued by its ghostly curves. The old man reached forward and flicked the circle so that it spun like a coin. It stopped so that Lynette was looking at the edge of the circle, where the dark and the white half were still divided by the line. Only now the circle drew closer, as though she were in an airplane descending into a slot canyon between the dark and the white.
"The line is what that cashier or your teachers or your mother sees when they look at you. If the mind is a mesa, then this little canyon in the middle is our only view into it. The Greeks called it the ego. I haven't given it a name yet. Maybe it has no name. But with the help of a magic mirror, you can look into it. Get inside. Tinker around. Like swapping plugs on a switchboard."
"Switchboard?" Lynette asked.
"Never mind," the hitchhiker responded. "Before your time."
"What are you saying?" Lynette asked. "You mean like hallucinations?"
The old man waved his hand impatiently. "Merlin had a man pull a sword from a stone, and people called it magic. A Jewish carpenter changed water into wine, and people called it a miracle. Magicians play the Vegas Strip, and people call it illusion. But I sell dreams, daughter, and dreams are real. Damn near unstoppable for dream throwers like you. And dreams are going to help you save lives."
"How am I going to help them?"
"Simple," said the hitchhiker. "You use the magic mirror, and you do what I tell you."
"There's just one thing I want to know," she said. "How do I know this isn't just a dream, too?"
The hitchhiker smiled. "I knew you were smart, daughter."
Lynette woke on her mattress in the darkness of the trailer. Rocky whined and licked at her feet. She rose breathless from her pillow, leashed him, and took him outside. They walked through the cold night air along the main road of the trailer court until Lynette saw someone under a distant streetlight. He was tall and lanky in a black hoodie. In his right hand, he held a rifle that he used to motion to someone in the shadows. When she saw Milo Roanhorse and the four other boys step into the light, she turned Rocky back to the trailer and locked the door. A half hour later, her mom pulled in, asked about school, and fell asleep on the couch. Lynette followed Rocky back to her room. As she slipped into an old t-shirt and sweatpants, Lynette turned to her magic mirror. Beneath it was a piece of yellow legal pad paper taped to the wall that read, "Tomorrow after school, on the mesa where you watched me. Bring the bottle and the dog. We'll need them." Rocky whined from the foot of her bed. On her dresser was the Heinz ketchup bottle. The next day, Lynette leashed Rocky and walked to the mesa with a ketchup bottle in her jacket pocket. The hitchhiker waved from a small sandstone boulder.
5 days until the bloodbath," he said without words. "You brought the dog and the bottle. Good."
He gave swift instructions, and Lynette placed the bottle on a small boulder and stood shoulder to shoulder with the hitchhiker. She smiled slightly when she realized she was taller than him. The lesson began. The hitchhiker had Lynette float her magic mirror over Rocky, like a wide periscope into his mind. She'd done this many times. It had made training him easy. He then taught her how to enter Rocky's colorblind vision, and the world turned to dull colors and sepia shades. The challenge was to vanish the ketchup bottle so Rocky couldn't see it. Lynette felt her thoughts travel like hair blowing forward and saw the ketchup bottle fade from red to the same sand color of the boulders. Then something distracted her, an itching sensation like an ant crawling into her ear. She brushed at it.
"It's a good start," the hitchhiker said. "Just think of your Uncle Danny."
Lynette had met Danny Yazzie, her father's brother, only once at a clan relative's wedding in Wood Springs, Arizona. During the cleanup afterwards, Danny yanked the tablecloth off a table, leaving the plates, glasses, and silverware where they'd sat. It was the first time Lynette had seen someone do something magical. Several broken plates and shattered glasses later, Lynette yanked her seventh tablecloth, and it flew flashing and flapping with plates, flatware, and upright glasses vibrating in their original places. Uncle Danny had clapped and cheered. She felt her thoughts travel out to Rocky's mirror. She yanked with her wrist, and the bottle vanished for an eye blink. Lynette yanked two more times. After the 14th pull, she could vanish the ketchup bottle for nearly 5 seconds.
"Rough, but getting there," the hitchhiker said, laughing quietly.
He pulled out a freezer bag of hamburger, rolled out a large, juicy patty, and threw it in front of Rocky. The dog didn't even notice it.
"Eventually, you'll get that good," he said.
"Pretty cool for an old geezer," Lynette said, laughing quietly, until she was cut off by a rifle blast. A second shot and the ketchup bottle shattered. The hitchhiker dropped to his haunches and tossed his straw hat aside.
"Don't move, daughter," he said firmly. "They're just trying to scare us. Probably out shooting for rabbits and got bored."
Lynette grabbed Rocky's collar as the dog barked fiercely.
"Sit still, daughter," the hitchhiker said, crawling along the edge of the mesa until he lay prone, his pine gum eyes working along the southwest. "Shots came from those tamarisks down along the stream bed."
"Can you see them?" she said.
"There's two of them," he said. "Some older kid in black flappy pants and a younger kid in a red t-shirt. You know them?"
"Yes," she said, remembering last night beneath the street lamp.
"The older one's Adrian Roanhorse. The other one's his brother, Milo."
The hitchhiker turned to her, smiling.
"He's still angry about you cold-cocking him?"
Lynette tried not to laugh, but the hitchhiker's joke was enough to loosen her grip, and Rocky broke free, sprinting down the side of the mesa, barking hoarsely.
"No!" Lynette yelled, running after him.
"Hey!" the hitchhiker said, leaping down the sandy slope after her.
"Better not run that way!"
She sprinted downhill as Rocky sped towards the two boys emerging from the tamarisks. Adrian Roanhorse cleared the bolt of his .22 rifle while Milo pointed ahead to Rocky. Adrian chambered around and aimed at the dog.
"Hey!" Lynette yelled. "You son of a bitch!"
She hung magic mirrors over their heads and yanked the tablecloth with everything she had. Lynette could feel Adrian blinking stupidly at his vanished target. The dog was gone.
"What the hell?"
Milo yelled.
"Come on, bro. Let's go!"
Adrian fired the round into the air, flipped his middle finger, and ran after Milo. The hitchhiker flipped his own middle finger in return, while Rocky covered Lynette's face with sloppy, hamburger-scented kisses.
"Hago shinshitsi. Very good, daughter," he said, helping Lynette to her feet. "You earn an A today. Soon you'll be ready to pull that tablecloth when it matters."
"It mattered today," she said.
"It'll matter more for your friends when this is all over," he said.
"I don't have any friends," she said, turning her eyes to the sand.
"You've got one," he said, rubbing Rocky's head. "And when this is all over, you'll have many more."
They arrived at the trailer court long before Lynette's mother returned from work. As the hitchhiker walked away uphill, Lynette felt a small electrical tingle against her ear.
"Tomorrow,"
he said without speaking,
"be at the mesa."
"I will," she said.
"And bring the dog."
The next day, Lynette's eighth grade science teacher, Mrs. Patty Briggs, had to cancel her scheduled geology exam until Friday. She had photocopied the tests that morning, had set the warm copies down in her desk, but when the bell rang, she couldn't find them anywhere. After school, Lynette met the hitchhiker beneath the naked canopy of a tall cottonwood in the wash and learned what the old man called the aging way. Lynette learned to gray Rocky's muzzle and ears, then work his face like it was wet clay until his gums drooped limp along his slimming snout so that he looked like a mastiff. Afterward, they reached the trailer just as the sun plated the dark clouds in western mesas with bright copper. The fading light made it all the easier to notice the single .22 bullet glinting on the banister of Lynette's plywood porch.
"We're running out of time," the hitchhiker said.
"Four more days. Sleep well, daughter. You get an A+ again for today. Just be at the mesa tomorrow."
That night, Lynette smiled in front of her silver mirror. She spit onto her thumb and wiped the pale sycamore scar away from her skin as though it were hardened candle wax. The hitchhiker hadn't taught her this, but Lynette had learned it was never too early to start preparing. The next day, the hitchhiker taught her what he called the weather way. How to change the weather of the mind, make it storm, snow, shine with heat and freeze with cold, rack it with pain, and confuse it with pleasure. It reminded Lynette of her mother weaving rugs at the traditional loom in the back of their trailer, moving yarn through thin vertical warp strings, flattening them tight, stopping some with quick knots while lengthening others, until an image began to take shape from the wool and cotton. So Lynette wove, and she didn't stop until she'd tricked Rocky into thinking he was on the edge of heat stroke despite the cool spring breeze. That night, Adrian Roanhorse couldn't get the water hot enough in his auntie's shower. He turned the handle to full heat, resigning himself to the lukewarm spray that trailed over his back and down his legs. He cursed his aunt's cheap hot water heater as he shampooed his hair. He cursed again when he heard the smoke alarm go off. When he turned the water off, the shower suddenly filled with steam. His auntie, Regina Rowanhorse, heard his screams from her garden on the house's west side. She would later tell the doctors at Sage Memorial Hospital that when she opened the door and saw the thick steam, she thought Adrian was burning something in the kitchen. The house smelled like frying bacon. The next day, the hitchhiker taught Lynette the hunger way. He explained how the mind was made of hungers, like a rug was made of yarn, and those hungers could be unwoven, untied, and then changed before they were woven again. He took out a piece of cabbage and tossed it to the sand. Rocky went for it like it was a piece of beef jerky.
That could be really dangerous, Lynette said.
And difficult, said the hitchhiker, even for an experienced dream thrower. Like untying an entire rug to reweave only a small piece. But you'll need the hunger way to help you stop whatever is coming the day after tomorrow. You're a smart kid, daughter, and your mom's a weaver. That means you're a weaver, too. You'll get it.
They worked until after the sun had set, until Lynette undid the hitchhiker's work and had Rocky refusing the cabbage. They walked across the prairie dog field in the dark toward the trailer court. On the way, the hitchhiker told Lynette a story she'd heard nearly every winter just before the frosts broke in the spring, of the Navajo hero twins, Nayanezane, monster slayer, and Tobashichchini, born for water, who had been given great weapons of lightning and flint to kill the monsters and giants that once terrorized the Navajo world. The hitchhiker pulled a folded piece of yellow legal pad paper from his jacket pocket and told Lynette that if she followed his map tomorrow, she'd be able to find the weapons she needed to save the students' lives on Monday. After her mother left the next morning to drive Lynette's uncle to his medical appointment at the VA hospital in Prescott, Lynette locked Rocky in the bathroom, stuffed the hitchhiker's map in her pocket, and walked south along the highway toward Navajo Station. The hitchhiker's direction led her off the main road and into a low valley thick with sagebrush and greasewood beneath the blue sky that had begun to feather with cirrus clouds across the eastern horizon, a sign of rain in the next few days, maybe even a storm. Eventually, she came to the small white ranch house, its paint gleaming like white shell under the cold noon sun. Nobody was home. She followed the hitchhiker's notes and unlocked the gun safe inside. She knew what would happen afterward was a test, and that she would need the weapons to help her prepare. Lynette arrived at her trailer just before dark, a piece of beef jerky in her coat pocket for Rocky. She hadn't paid for the jerky. There was no longer any need for that. She merely wove the quarters and put them in the cashier's hands at the gas station. And no one had seen the weapon she'd wrapped in a bath towel under her arm. Lynette had seen to that. When she entered the trailer and went to hide the weapons in her closet, she heard a soft clapping and a high-pitched whining. At first, she thought it was Rocky begging to be let out of the bathroom. But as she entered the hallway, she saw the back door standing open and shifting in the breeze. The lock had been forced, the catch twisted and broken. The bathroom door was open, and when Lynette ran through it, she found Rocky lying stiff on his side in the bathtub. His tongue hung out of his mouth, a sick shade of purple. A thin trail of blood led from his head to the drain. Through her tears and roaring cries, Lynette ran her hands through his coarse blue-gray hair until she found a small hole behind his left ear. It was the size of a .22 bullet. She knew her mother would be home soon, so she wrapped the dog in her old sweatshirt and carried him to the mesa, where she buried him just as the full moon emerged from the horizon like a silver eye awakening to a darker world. Lynette awakened with that eye and sent her magic mirrors all across the valley, brilliant and dangerous, like Coyote once had scattered the stars into the night. The next day was the sixth day, and Lynette had prepared. That morning she cut through the wash and followed the sandy arroyo bed to where it ran next to Ganado Middle School. She set up behind some boulders across from the basketball court. There she'd unwrapped the weapons and laid them across the towel. The Ruger Mini 14 ranch rifle she'd taken from the gun safe inside the white ranch house shined oily and deadly next to the Nickel Colt 45 semi-automatic pistol. Next to the guns, she set a box of .223 shells. Then she watched the three exits that led to the recess grounds and waited, biting her lip to keep herself awake. She'd not slept the night before. That night had been for looking into mirrors and weaving. When the students came out for recess, Lynette darted in and out of their minds like flicking between television channels. And she knew each of their minds well. After she'd buried Rocky on the mesa, Lynette had started with the middle school students, looking for any strands of Rocky's murderer. She found them in Milo Rowanhorse, but he'd not acted alone, and he'd told others what he was going to do to Rocky. And those students had told many others. Through word of mouth and the backlit silicon magic of Facebook, everyone knew. Anybody could have warned her. But nobody did. But Lynette hadn't stopped there. She descended into the dream canyons of the students' minds, the blind, twisted depths between the white plains of what the students knew and the dark deserts of what they did not. There she'd seen Milo Roanhorse sitting in his bedroom, fondling the 9mm Glock that his brother had kept under his mattress, loading and unloading the magazine, thinking about how Adrian should have used it against Lynette the day he'd given her the scar on her jaw. But he'd give her some new scars when the next chance came, and the same went for any other Bijou's Dijois who had laughed after that bitch had tossed him and his bros into the girls' bathroom in front of the whole goddamn school. He was going to pay them back. All of them. Lynette had hiked further into the students' dream canyons and seen all the childhood crimes and deep hatreds that hummed along the dark borders. And from those borders fumed the death smell of confused anger, like a rapist panting at her ear, stinking with hormones and guile and want. She had seen enough to understand the true nature of the hitchhiker's final test and how she would save the students. She would save them from themselves, from their dreams, from their nightmares. Lynette loaded the rifle while Milo Roanhorse and his friends bounced their basketballs and cycled through a game of horse. Then she lifted the rifle to her shoulder and found Milo through the peep sight. When Milo collapsed, his friends continued through their game. Their sneakers left crimson footprints when they stepped through the blood pooling from the bullet hole in Milo's temple. They had not heard the gunshot and couldn't see Milo dead, just like Adrian Roanhorse hadn't sensed the scalding water. Last night, Lynette had taken time to reweave some of the patterns inside the students' minds. She fired until the rifle clicked dry, and Milo's friends twitched dead on the court while the other students played around them. "Yes," she said. "Twitching like trout." She reloaded the rifle and mentally counted her remaining bullets in the box. She had brought more than enough for this final test. Perhaps that was why the hitchhiker had chosen her. Lynette Yazzie knew how to prepare for tests. Always had.
It's quite difficult, sometimes, to not view life as a never-ending series of exams, of tests. Whether it's trying to keep your head above water at work, making sure you're nice to your friends and loved ones, or yourself, or actually studying for a test, there's a lot going on most of the time. In fact, as one of the 20th century's last prominent philosophers put it, life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around every once in a while, you miss it. The thing is, though, sometimes that's basically impossible. Sometimes all you have is the next test, the next challenge. Sometimes it's not a path, it's a treadmill. Sometimes it can't be done. Sometimes you fail. I'm not going to spout the old thing about how life never gives you more than you can handle, because that's crap. It does, frequently. You will fail, you will fall, you will break. You will let yourself and other people down. Now, dancing girls! But that's not the point. Although, the dancing girls aren't the point either. The point is not to be defined by these tests, not to be defined by the binary of success, failure, pass, fail, win, lose. The point is approach them differently. Accept you will fail, you will fall, you will break. Accept it, and in doing so, accept the fact that lies behind it. The comforting, warm heart of every single lousy choice, every human born to date, and chances are, every human that will be born, will ever make. We're fallible. We're human. And we're not alone. We screw up. In fact, we excel at screwing up to the level that bonobos are out in the woods right now, in between bouts of rampant group sex, discussing exactly how we've been able to get this far, considering how often we fall over. And being bonobos, chances are discussing how we've managed to get this far without having as much group sex as they do. Anyway, the answer, which the bonobos will one day learn and use to control us all, is simple. We keep getting up. We keep going. We keep accepting things that are tough and will stay tough for a while, but we, when it comes down to it, are tougher. As another well-known philosopher once said, we are big damn heroes, and sometimes that means realizing that being broken is a victory too. Give us your money. I could beg. I could dress this up in fiery language, but the simple truth is this. We need your money to keep going. So if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org, click on Feed the Pod, and make an author happy. Pseudopod is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and will return, like James Bond, next week with Learning to Fly by Garth Upshaw. In the meantime, Pseudopod will sit here quietly and listen to the sound of the drums beating in its heart.